Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast 20 for October 13th, 2009. I'll be your host this week. My name is David O'Brien, and I have my usual cast with me today, including
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, we have our three stories for you this week, including these new FTC guidelines on endorsements and testimonials for social media. We're also going to cover the YouTube and the actual knowledge dispute, which was covered on TechDirt this week. And finally, our last story is going to be somewhat of an update on the Systar litigation, which has been going on now for some time. So, diving right into the first story, the FTC came out this week and released these new guidelines that have to do with product endorsements and the way that bloggers talk about product reviews and what might happen when a blogger is either receiving some sort of compensation or a free product in return for either a positive review or an actual review on that product. And this is sort of interesting, too, because in recent weeks we saw a very recent controversy pop up with David Pogue and the review that he had posted in the New York Times. He's the New York Times one of the New York Times technology columnists, or I think it might actually be a blog. In any event, he had posted a review of Snow Leopard, and he'd give it a very positive review and had called it almost a necessary update for Mac users, and a lot of people thought that it wasn't really a necessary update. He received a lot of critical commentary based on that post, and it was also brought to the attention that he's also writing books on the side, which he's done for a while, and so people had sort of accused him that he had some sort of monetary benefit or conflict of interest that was involved. So anyways, this sort of relates directly to what the FTC has done here, and probably to start us off, would one of you guys want to tell me a little bit more about what the FTC does and why they might have jurisdiction over something like this?
Yeah, absolutely. The FTC is the Federal Trade Commission, and essentially the reason why they have jurisdiction over this is because they get to regulate things like marketing and fair business practices and advertisements. So in this case, they're considering a paid review, or if the reviewer gets something for free and doesn't disclose it, they're considering it like a paid advertisement. And the result of that is they don't want people to be confused between the differences between what would be a neutral advertisement, or rather a neutral review where somebody either purchases it or gets a loaner unit for a period of time to do a review, and a review where the person was given the product for free or where they're being paid to give a review that's presumptively positive.
And this is the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, not to be confused with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which
right.
doesn't regulate this. But the Federal Trade Commission, because this is paid, right? Basically because these are paid ads, that's why?
Yes. Okay. That's actually a great point. So if these weren't paid advertisements or the like, the FTC actually wouldn't have any jurisdiction over it. Because of restraints that the First Amendment puts on the government trying to regulate speech, the FTC would only have power to regulate something that's commercial speech, and that's speech that's, you know, for the financial benefit of the speaker and the targeted audience. It's usually things like advertisements and commercials.
So is the FTC also sort of set up similarly, though, to the FCC in terms of the way the commissioner structure works and how they promulgate new rules?
In that they're a federal regulatory authority, yes. I'm not really familiar with exactly how they're set up, but they have to follow the same things, the same guidelines.
As far as I know, and I was just really looking for confirmation, it is pretty much the same. They have five commissioners, and those five commissioners will – and there's guidelines to how the commissioners have to be set up, I think. You can only have a certain number which are partisan for each party, and – I believe the five of them will vote on rules, and then you have to have, of course, a majority vote before something actually becomes an enforceable rule. But here, we're not really dealing with rules. We're dealing with these things called guidelines. What are guidelines?
A guideline is usually less concrete than a rule. I'm not sure. David, are there procedural differences between how guidelines are put into place and how rules are put into place?
Not necessarily. As far as I know, there is still just you have a vote on it from the commissioners. But I think the net effect that you get out of this is that the guidelines themselves are not binding law. Instead, they work something like an administrative interpretation of how the law would be applied And since they are the agency that governs this particular area, they would also be the one that's enforcing their own regulations. And so they're saying, this is how we are going to enforce the rules that are already in place, I think, unless you guys have a different understanding.
The news articles I've read seem to use rules and guidelines interchangeably. I don't know whether that's just sloppy journalism or whether there isn't a distinction.
I think it is, because the rules technically, I think, would be actual binding law, and like I said, the guidelines would not be. But it does give some indication of how the FTC would proceed based on the law that's already in place under the federal regulations.
Yeah, that's interesting because if these aren't promulgated like rules are, where they're published first and then there's a notice and comment period and then the FCC responds to any criticism that these rules have, the FCC's interpretation of the rules will only hold so much. I'm sorry, the FTC's
Yes.
interpretation of the rules will only hold so much weight if a blogger is either hit with one of these fines and sues to overturn it or preemptively sues the FTC to try to.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing is that if these rules are going to be challenged, and we haven't even talked about the rules yet, but we're going to get into that real soon. If they are going to challenge, if someone wants to challenge these rules, meaning like the constitutionality of these rules, or perhaps how they might interact with a different area of federal law, there would have to be some case or controversy in present. And if they're just published as guidelines, that makes it much more difficult. You'd actually have to have the FTC go after some people first, right?
No. This, I could, like, if we started reviewing products on our blog and I submitted a complaint, it would be for declaratory judgment, like we've talked about before, where you sue preemptively to keep somebody from suing you. All I would have to allege is that I do product reviews, I do product reviews for money, I intend to do more product reviews for money, and I don't want to be fined. I think that would be sufficient to let that suit go through, to have standing for it.
So now we can just like dive right into these rules here because I think that's where the meat of what our discussion should be at. And this was a huge report. It was something like 80 pages long, and it is full of commentary and the FTC's comments on commentary that they received. I think they had actually released these in a draft form some period of time ago. It's not like they just came up with these this week. And anyways, they had an interesting way of modifying the guidelines that had already been in place, and they did it through a series of examples and stuff. Do you guys just remember what some of the more interesting points were? And there's like just two or three from the report.
I like this one. You'll be able to describe on. Well, first of all, if you feature a testimonial, you'll have to disclose whether or not that testimonial was paid. And this is generally for advertisers, more than for bloggers. But I mean, it would apply the same way. Not only that, if you can include a testimonial that includes a quote unusual result, as long as the testimonial contains the disclaimer such as quote results not typical. So.
Right. And so we see that actually in like common advertising. Someone took a weight loss supplement on TV, and you always see at the bottom of the screen, results not typical. And that's why that's there is because it might have been an unusual result. So I think that the way that they described that the relationship is whether or not there was a material connection. And they define that in these new guidelines as a connection that a consumer might not expect. Any of those, a blogger would have to disclose that there was some sort of connection going on. What do you guys think that could mean?
It certainly means if you're being paid to do the review, I certainly wouldn't expect that. I think the more interesting question is whether or not free review a free review unit counts as something that you wouldn't expect.
Right. And do you know, have any idea how that works when you're blogging about product reviews?
Free review units?
Yes.
To the best of my knowledge, well, there are two ways that it can happen. First of all, you can request a free review unit, and then you would, if the company wants you to do a review, if you have enough readership, if they think that you'll give them a positive review, those things, they'll send you a unit. Let's say it's a phone that you're reviewing. They'll send you a phone that has a SIM card. It's all loaded up and ready to go. And either you can keep it for a couple of weeks and then return it, or sometimes these free review units will be totally free review units that they just send you and you get to keep. I think the latter of those two raises more questions than the former. The free review units, where it's just a short period of time and you have to return it, is significantly, I think, more typical. It's the kind of thing that people expect, at least in my experience. While as a free review unit that you get to keep indefinitely is not something that you expect as much.
The problem, one of the problems to me is that even if you do disclose that you were given some sort of unit for review, it just seems like there could be so many ways, because this is just a little bit ambiguous in its wording, there could be so many ways that you could disclose that, but might not get the effect of that relationship across to the consumer that might be reading the product review.
What do you mean, the effect of that relationship?
Well, the purpose of this seems to be that you want to that the consumers should know that you're receiving something in compensation, or, you know, in a loose form of compensation, a free unit. And if you just say, based on the review unit that I received from such and such, you could have possibly just satisfied this requirement to disclose that material connection, but you might not have gotten across that you're keeping the unit.
Do you think it matters that, I mean, would that you get to keep it? I mean,
absolutely it matters.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's the difference between, you know, renting a phone for 2 weeks and the difference between keeping a phone for the iPhone. It's a huge difference.
Wouldn't that constitute a payment, though, in terms of being able to keep the unit in some sense? The de facto payment, I guess?
Yeah, that's my point, is that
the rules just say it has to be clear and conspicuous, and it doesn't say exactly, or I'm sorry, the guidelines just say that it has to be clear and conspicuous, and it doesn't say exactly how it has to be revealed. So
that's exactly my point.
That's your
point,
yeah.
That's what makes it sort of confusing, and I don't know. But then again, you know, these are, like we said, they're just guidelines, so they're saying this is how we are going to apply the law that's already in place. One of the next big takeaways I got from this was this, that there's going to be liability for false or unsubstantiated claims made by the bloggers. And if you read down at the end of the example, and I think this is on page 63 or 64 of the guidelines, if you want to follow along in example 5, it says that the advertiser could also have liability imposed on him through that too. And that seems to be a little bit problematic with the Communications Decency Act Section 230, which would seemingly limit that liability potential. Because you have a third-party blogger who is reviewing a product on behalf of an advertiser, and somehow with that third-party content, the advertiser is now going to have liability imposed on him on something that the blogger said. What do you guys think?
Well, the third-party advertiser paid the blogger, or are they just an innocent bystander in some sense?
Well, you have to assume that in the course of the product review, there has either been some sort of compensation, be it monetary or a free unit or something like that, or maybe some sort of other giveaways. That's what I would suspect. I mean, there could be other odd forms of compensation too, like you could get link throughs from the the product manufacturer's website and stuff. But
so say I'm a widget manufacturer and I hire renowned blogger David O'Brien to write a review of my wonderful new widget. And I send him a new widget and I say, here is my new widget. If you could review it, you will get to keep the widget free forever. It's wonderful. You write a review, you fail to disclose it, that I gave you this widget for free to keep. And then I, the widget manufacturer, get sued or get fined by the FTC because you didn't disclose it?
Actually, what I'm talking about is two separate examples that were given in the guidelines. The second one is that the blogger who's doing the product review could be held liable for any false or unsubstantiated claims made in the blog about the product. So say I say that your new widget cures cancer, and it's completely unsubstantiated about your widget. Of course, as a blogger, I could be held liable for making that false statement. But what the guidelines are now saying is that you, as the product manufacturer, the advertiser, since you're the one that's basically paying me to advertise, you could also be held liable for what I have said on my blog. Because it's a false statement. But it would seem to me, though, and other commentators on the web have also noted, that seems to sort of conflict with what the Communications Decency Act, which imposes that liability limitation on people for writing content. So how could the advertiser be held liable for that?
Well, first thing, I want to try to narrow this a little bit. At least by my reading, this only applies to when there are endorsements in play, and I think that this is trying to draw a line between an endorsement and a review.
Okay.
We're reading from 255. You were saying section 5? Or 255.5 or 255.1D?
I don't, you know what, I don't have the number, but I do know that it's on page 63 or 64 of that PDF.
Okay. So right here I'm reading, advertisers subject to liability for false or unsubstantiated statement made through endorsements or by failing to disclose material connections between themselves and endorsers. And then it says see section 255.5. So I think there's an important line there between endorsements and reviewers.
Is there, though? I mean, it seems to me that if you are given compensation to write a review about a product, it's sort of implicit that you're going to write a positive review, although I'm sure there are unbiased reviewers out there that do not do that. I think that, though, that what sometimes does happen is that the advertiser is expecting a positive review, and so by way of writing the review, you're also endorsing it yourself as a blogger, right?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. And now that I'm looking more closely at some of these examples, some of them seem to lean that way too. That the bloggers could be also liable. Even if it's not like even if they're not paying for an endorsement, they could still get that.
Anyways, it's an interesting point, and some of the legal experts out there that have legal blogs, the one that I'm thinking of off the top of my head is Eric Goldman, wrote about this week, seems to think that these two areas of the law conflict and that it's going to be ripe for a challenge in terms of the effectiveness of these new guidelines. But I guess that's something that we'll have to wait and see and how that might actually pan out in a court decision. Do you guys have any other thoughts, maybe any First Amendment thoughts about how that might interact with First Amendment standards and the FTC's ability to regulate this area of speech?
Other than what I've already mentioned about there being lessened scrutiny for commercial speech, I don't think there's much to add. That's not being said that, you know, the FTC has free rein over commercial speech, and we don't really have time to go into the nuances of that law right now, but these on their face, they seem to be okay, given the scope of the FTC's power. The problem is if at any time these kind of move into the area of trying to regulate speech that isn't commercial, but it looks like we're okay for now.
Right. I mean, that's an interesting point, is whether or not you consider a product review blog commercial speech. I think for our purposes today and for practical purposes, yes, I think that line is now kind of clear that bloggers are also can be advertisers at the same time involved in commercial speech. And just in case anyone's interested, I think that the case is the Central Hudson case from the Supreme Court that talks about commercial speech, and that standard that they would apply is whether there's a substantial government interest that, and it can't be more extensive than necessary to serve that interest. So that's how that would pan out, I guess, in a First Amendment type of an argument. Any final thoughts before we move on?
Nope, I'm good. Dominic?
Nope.
So this next case was pretty interesting, especially in light of the news that we've had over the last month or so, especially with the VO case. TechDirt reported this week that there's now a smoking gun potentially in the YouTube case. I think it's the YouTube and Viacom case involving the Section 512 DMCA safe harbor. And what TechDirt was reporting is that it became known, and I think CNET reported on this too, that there are some smoking gun type emails that were found at YouTube that seem to say that company executives knew, at least in one or two circumstances, that there was infringing material on YouTube and decided not to take it down. And the intersection, or the interplay with the Section 512C safe harbor is sort of interesting here, because it's a very broadly worded statute. So maybe we could just give a quick overview of the Section 512C if one of you guys has it handy.
Sure. Basically, 512C is a safe harbor, which means that if the service provider or the internet host, if you will, follows the steps here, then they are safe from any potential liability. In other words, it's a set of steps that if someone, they're accused of hosting infringement, they can follow these steps to basically get to be safe. And the text of the language is, or the text of the statute is, a service provider should not be liable for monetary relief for infringement of copyright by reason of the storage at the direction of a user of material that resides on a system or network. In other words, if someone uploads it to them, the service provider isn't liable if, and then there's three components, one of which is that the service provider doesn't actually know that it's infringing, does not have actual knowledge, or isn't aware of facts and circumstances that would make such infringing action apparent. And if upon obtaining actual knowledge or awareness, acts quickly to remove or disable access to the material, that's one. So second is that there isn't a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity if the service provider can control the activity. And third, if upon notification that someone says, hey, you're infringing right here, then they can expeditiously remove or disable access to material that is supposedly infringing. This one is the one that comes up the most because usually service providers get infringement notices from people who are out there looking out for their content. And so this would be 512.1c, which is the notification of claimed infringement.
Right. And so actually I wrote a blog post that was posted on our site this week that sort of went through a lot of the nuances that you can find in 512. So that's a good place to start in case any of the listeners are interested in taking a closer look at the statutory language. So this whole concept, though, of actual knowledge, though, is really, really important to 512C because it seems to be very ambiguously worded. What really does constitute actual knowledge? And obviously in this case, the Viacom people they want to have a much broader interpretation of what actual knowledge means. And here, I think what they would want to do is that they would want to say just a few people knowing over at YouTube that there was some sort of infringing material available on the site and that conscious decision not to take it down is enough to satisfy that actual knowledge standard. But what do you guys think about actual knowledge now in light of the Veo case? And what did the Veo case say?
So I guess my first thing that I'd like to point out about actual knowledge is that the way at least the statute's written, if they wanted to say that that actual knowledge meant, let me rephrase that. If YouTube was trying to argue that actual knowledge just means that the only way we can actually know about it is takedown notices, then I don't think they've got a very good argument. Because if the statute meant that, it would say, you know, this section that we're talking about would say, YouTube has not received a takedown notice. So I think actual knowledge is more than just a takedown notice, that there are other ways to establish actual knowledge. Does that argument make sense, guys?
It does, because I think one of the thing, and I should have said this too, one of the big contention points is that a lot of the copyright holders have said, well, just because you operate a service like YouTube where people are constantly uploading infringing materials, if we give you just broad notice that say this artist's materials are being uploaded to the site without our authorization, that enough is alone for you to start looking out for anyone that uploads anything that has a tag on it or has any reference to that artist and take it down. So rather than having a specific notice for each video that gets uploaded, it'd be more like this blanket notice kind of thing where we say, you know, such and such artist right now is having all these materials uploaded and we don't want them up there. Please take them all down.
Yeah.
What did the Veo case say about that?
The Veo case said that you can't do that blanket notification.
Right, and so it seemed to say that just a broad compliance with the takedown, if you are complying with the takedown procedures that are specified in the statute, that enough is good enough to have the safe harbor apply to you.
Right, but that being said, I do want to go back to the studio's view of this. That their view of actual knowledge, that if at any point you know that there is a copyright being infringed, that seems too broad. It doesn't strike me as that's what the statute meant. I mean, it says that you must not have, quote, actual knowledge that the material on the network is infringing. I guess another question is, what does the material mean? Does that mean the owner's content, or does that mean the content on the network? Or, no, it's got to mean that the content on the network. So they would have to point to actual knowledge that a specific file, a specific material on the network is infringing.
I really honestly think that it's just too ambiguous to say one way or another. I mean, that phrase actual knowledge is so broad. I could see how both arguments have merit, that you either need to point to a very specific uploaded video in the notice, or if you do have knowledge that something is infringing, just broadly, that almost seems to be enough to take it down. But yeah, I guess this really speaks more to the way that the takedown section works in the statute, because the takedown section is very detailed. It has like 7 or 8 points in it that say that your takedown notice must include the following, and among that is some sort of identification of the actual materials. So maybe that weighs a little bit more in favor of what you're saying, Ben.
Right, that even if you don't hit the exact requirements of the takedown notice, there does have to be enough specificity to a specific file or activity that's going on that website to enable the people to take it down. My next question is Viacom's argument in this case that YouTube's knowledge of a couple of infringing activities kill their entire immunity under the statute, their entire safe harbor, or just that it kills their safe harbor status with respect to those files?
I don't think so. I think it's just those files, but...
in that case, doesn't this seem like more of a smoking, I don't know, slingshot instead of a smoking gun? This is a $1 billion lawsuit. You know, a liability toward a couple of files, even if you get statutory damages, isn't even going to scratch the surface of $1 billion.
Well, maybe it speaks, though, more just to the sort of inference of knowledge kind of concept, and maybe that's how they're trying to apply it to everything. And they're saying, hey, look, they knew at least that there are a couple things that are infringing that were on there, and they chose consciously not to take them down. So therefore, they're probably doing it for all.
From what I understand, basically the argument they're making is not just that they knew, but that YouTube employees were uploading infringing materials themselves, which they're going to try to make this argument that, look, these guys are uploading infringing materials themselves to their site. They didn't really care about finding infringement stuff. They had actual knowledge because they were putting it up themselves. That means that we didn't have actual knowledge defense for other infringement, even if they didn't do it. That defense is pretty spurious just because they've been uploading infringing materials. They could care less about monitoring for infringing materials. It's sort of what Ben is saying, that look, if they've infringed in these cases because they uploaded it themselves, well, clearly then they didn't really care about looking out for infringing material if other people were uploading it, if they themselves were uploading it. I think that seems to be the...
Yeah, that's a really good point, because another argument that these content holders are making is that based on the language in 512C and based on this actual knowledge standard, it also somehow imposes some sort of duty on these companies, these service providers, to have filtering technology in place that can quickly identify and take this stuff down. That hasn't really fared too well, though, like in the Veo case.
Right.
So what do you think, though, about just a few company executives having knowledge then of infringing material, and they knew that it was not authorized to be on there and decided not to take it down? It seems like you guys are saying that that's really not enough to kill the safe harbor immunity in this case.
Yeah, I think that accurately sums up my feeling here, that that's just, it may be enough for those specific instances, but it's not enough to strip out the safe harbor for the entire site.
I agree with Ben, although I think they're going to try to make the argument that it shows a general sort of lack of respect, for lack of a better word, that makes that they would try to say it just shows that, hey, they don't really care. And they would try to strip immunity for the entire site. I'm not sure they would be successful, though.
One of the more positive things that has favored on the side of the service providers, though, has been that they have always said that we comply with what we're expected to do in the 512 safe harbor, and judges seem to say, like, look, they're doing as much as they can to comply with the safe harbor, and that's why it should apply to them. But this whole argument of the smoking gun emails or whatever seem to favor a little bit more on the content providers, and it's sort of interesting. I don't know how the judge is actually going to treat this, but it's definitely something we're going to have to keep our eyes on, and you know, I think that there's a lot of merit, though, to what you guys are saying. So, any final thoughts before we move on?
I do, and it's going to sound like a bit of a digression first, but I'm going to go see a concert on Tuesday, and one of the opening acts is a band that I haven't heard of before, and I went to their MySpace site to see if I could listen to their music, see what they're going to be like, see if I want to show up for the opening act. I navigate to their regular website, and I find that I can download their entire album for free. I'm going to download their album, I'm going to listen to it, I'm probably going to end up go watching them, and I may even buy, you know, some swag from theirs at their concert. none of which I would probably do if I had to sit on their MySpace page and try to listen to their music on the MySpace page the entire time. Content producers, and we've said this a million times, and other people have said it, they need to realize that the best way sometimes to control their content is not to try to, you know, grab it with an iron fist. Just like the Empire in Star Wars, you know, the more they tighten their grip, the more galaxies will slip through their fingers.
Wow.
Great reference there. Well, I really do appreciate that argument, but at the same time, though, you do have some of these content holders who have active YouTube accounts, and they do upload their videos to YouTube. And so you can go and preview some of these songs, and that's another argument that they make, is that, you know, there is an authorized way on these websites, especially YouTube being, I think, the largest, to view that content, and it doesn't have to be uploaded by someone who is infringing on the rights of the content holders.
Right, and I don't, and even in my example, it was that band that decided to put their stuff up for free. So, you know, absolutely there, right, David.
Yeah, there are alternative ways, and I hopefully, though, in the future, we'll see these companies become more interested in embracing some of these alternative methods of distribution. But, you know, this is what they're doing for now, and, you know, I don't think that there's much else under the law that prevents them from enforcing those rights as they are. So why don't we move on to our last case, and this is an interesting one because this litigation has been going on forever, for at least the last year and a half now. It started, this is the SciStar case, and it started all the way back in, I think, about April 2008, just to give you a quick rundown. This tiny little Florida corporation audaciously announced on their website that they were going to be offering personal computers, PCs, non-Apple computers with OS X preloaded onto them for substantially lower prices. And in the Apple EULA, that's the end user license agreement, of course, Apple has this provision in there which prevents people from installing OS X onto a non-Apple labeled hardware device. And of course, this company was flying right in the face of that. And this went on for like a month or two. It was all over the tech news sites, and finally we found out around July 2008 that Apple had filed a suit in California, and of course seeking to, among other things, enjoin SciStar from selling these devices, and they also wanted to go after them for all sorts of statutory damages based under the Copyright Act and breach of contract claims. And SciStar came back and they filed a counterclaim, and they raised a bunch of antitrust issues against Apple. And what was sort of interesting is they, in the California case, they were not focusing so much on the validity of the EULA itself. Instead, they were more focusing on the anti-competitive nature of how Apple licenses its software. So this went on for that whole year, and I think the next couple of serious updates we got on the case didn't happen to almost a year later, after a series of motions that SciStar had filed. And in between this time, too, I think SciStar had actually filed for bankruptcy in Florida. SciStar recently in August also filed a second suit in Florida. And they sort of differentiated their claims from the California claims. And in the Florida case, they're also raising antitrust claims, but they're also trying to attack the EULA and trying to seek that this particular EULA, trying to seek that the EULA be declared invalid. So the news this week, that should give us a good rundown on where we are in the case. The news this week is that SciStar announced that they were going to begin OEM licensing of this virtualization technology that they use. And based on the technology, you can install it onto a computer, and then you can just put in a, say, a Snow Leopard install CD or a DVD, and be able to install the Snow Leopard operating system right onto your machine, onto your PC device, the non-Apple labeled devices. All this is going on in the midst of all this litigation. Does one of you want to just talk really quickly about the technical aspects of why you need that virtualization technology in order to be able to install the operating system?
Yeah, although you guys may have to jump in because you guys are a little more hardware savvy than I am. Essentially, instead of BIOS, the new Apple computers have an alternative to it, and I'm blanking on the name of it. Do you, the guys you know, of you know what? It's EFI. EFI is the alternative to BIOS, right?
Right.
Right. So essentially what their hardware does is it I'm sorry, what their hardware, what their software does, what Sisar's software does is it interfaces between the open source components of Snow Leopard, the open source underpinnings are called Darwin, and it interfaces between that and the computer to kind of emulating the EFI in place of the BIOS, so that Darwin and eventually Snow Leopard can boot on a computer that does not have that alternative to BIOS on it.
Right, so the EFI software then, it basically is loaded onto the motherboards of Apple-labeled hardware products, and when you try to install a Apple operating system onto a machine, then the software checks to see, and there's critical components that are embedded into the EFI. So you have this interface going on between the hardware itself then and the operating system install CD that permits it to be installed onto the machine. It's probably a pretty good rundown, right, Dominic?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you guys did a great job.
So what do you guys think about where this litigation has turned? And it may be, Ben, if you want to just talk a tiny bit about what's going on in the Florida case. How is it that we can have two suits going on, one in California and one in Florida at the same time?
Well, if I'm getting this right, and this is an incredibly confusing litigation, the Florida case was Sistar suing Apple. The California case was Apple suing Sistar.
Right.
Essentially what happened is in the beginning of the Apple case, the California case, we'll call it, Apple started that case. They announced Snow Leopard had been announced, and Apple did some wrangling to try to keep the Snow Leopard issue out of it and just talk about OS 10.5. Snow Leopard came out, Sistar started using that, and then sued Apple in Florida, basically saying, you know, we have the right to do this with Snow Leopard. Apple then turned around in California and said, wait a second, if they're going to bring this up in Florida, we have the right to fold that into the case that we're currently litigating in California. And the current state of that is that the judge in California has said, you know what, you guys tried to keep it out in the beginning, we're going to lean toward letting the Florida case go on unless the judge in Florida doesn't want it to, and then we'll just consolidate all the cases here in federal court in Florida.
Right. So
I'm sorry. Federal court in California.
California. Right. So in other words, the California case at this point is much further along than this Florida case is, and so and it's also interesting because Sistar didn't raise, as I mentioned before, they didn't raise certain claims involving the EULA itself in the California case, and once you don't do that in terms of federal procedure rules for when you're filing documents, you sort of waive your rights to making any of those claims in California. And then they went on to do it in Florida, though. And obviously, as you mentioned, Apple is challenging the filing of the suit in Florida as well. But what Sistar is saying, though, what differentiates these cases is that the suit in California is based off of OS X, I think, 10.5. And the one in Florida is actually based off of Snow Leopard. And they're also saying that there's a different licensing agreement that's in place that governs the Snow Leopard software than the one that is based off the OS X 10.5 software. So it's an odd interplay, but there does seem to be at least a little bit of legal merit as to why there should be two separate cases going on at the same time.
Right. We should probably mention who some of the new counsel is for Sistar in this case.
Right, so I added sort of recently within the last couple months is Kiwi Kamara, and Kiwi is famous for having litigated the Jamie Thomas Rasset case, which was the first big case that involved file sharing that went to trial and also received judgments.
Right,
and
but he didn't litigate it the first time around. He tried the second trial in that case.
The second trial, right. There's another case that he's also involved in, too.
The Scribd case.
Heard.
Yeah, Scribd case.
Scribd.
He's the one who's filing that on behalf of the person asserting copyright in that, as opposed to, in the other cases, he's been either defending people or suing for a limitation on the owner's copyright. It's kind of interesting. He's definitely it's interesting because he's willing to take these high profile cases and take not directly opposing views, but basically taking both sides on the issue.
Right, right. And also interesting in case you're interested more in Kiwi Kamara, he's fairly young too. He I think he's just turned 25, and he was noted to be the youngest person to matriculate from Harvard Law School in 2001. So he's been an attorney now for some time, from a very young age, and he's managed to bring himself up to the national spotlight very quickly in these very high-profile cases. So where do you think that the SciStar litigation is going to go from here, if we could even speculate as to what's going to happen next? What are the next steps?
Well, the next step in the California case would probably be some more motions for summary judgment. It seems like they've gotten pretty far along in discovery. Discovery is depositions, and it's, you know, sending files back and forth for people to review. Once that is over, you can kind of move into the trial phases. And we mentioned summary judgment, which is trying to dispose of certain issues where the parties either agree on all the facts or there aren't any important facts that haven't been developed. And the judge can just rule on those without having a full trial. So we'll probably start to see some movement there. And the Florida case, however, is just getting going. So either that's going to be folded into the California case, setting the whole litigation back a little bit, or they're going to proceed separately, and we're going to start to see some resolution in the California case. And
yes,
the Florida case is just going to start to ramp up.
The California case, I believe some of these news websites are reporting it to be scheduled for trial in January 2010. So actually, that's kind of just around the corner. I know that doesn't seem like it's very fast, but probably reasonably on schedule in terms of how litigation goes in a case that's that large. There's also a pending motion to dismiss on the Florida case that Apple has filed, and the parties have gone back and forth on their filings. So after the motion to dismiss was filed, that's where Apple was saying, this case shouldn't be going on. It's substantially the same as the case that's going on in California, and it does not belong here. They did not ask, as far as I know, in that case for consolidation. They just asked for dismissal, which is sort of interesting. So they're not saying, let's combine these two cases. They're saying, we want the Florida one to go away.
From my understanding, though, it would, if it does get dismissed in Florida, it would just be – the claims would be picked up in California. It's not like they would totally just go away.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that SciStar came back, of course, and they filed a reply motion, a reply brief, to the motion to dismiss. So they're contending that the suit should, in fact, stay on based on those reasons I said, that they think that the since it involves a different piece of software and a different license that is at issue, it should stay in Florida as a separate case. Sort of interesting, though, is just the difference in the claims that they have made in the Florida suit as compared to the California suit. Like I said before, SciStar's case in California has been largely based on this sort of antitrust concept, and the antitrust claims were along the lines of Apple has a monopoly in these high-end personal computer devices that have OS X on them, and they shouldn't be the only ones that are allowed to use Apple hardware's devices should not be the only ones that are allowed to use OS X. And those claims actually failed on a motion to dismiss, and they were dismissed out. Now I think all that's left at this point in terms of SciStar's side is a counterclaim for copyright misuse, which we talked about last week, I think it was, or recently.
Yep.
The Florida suit, in contrast, it has more of these antitrust issues brought up, but they're framed in a different light, and they've tried to raise the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act again, like they did in California, but we saw those fail there.
Are the antitrust acts, just to fill that in.
Thanks. Yes, those are the antitrust acts, and they are also saying the portions of the software that they're accessing in Snow Leopard are actually parts of the code that are based on BSD and the BSD license. So they're essentially open source licenses. And so we're not actually interacting with any of the proprietary code that Apple has. And why that's different is because Apple, one of the major points of contention that Apple has had is that there's this anti-circumvention section to the DMCA, which prohibits you from trying to get around, I'm trying to think of the word that they use in the statute.
Effective copy protection tools?
Yeah, correct. You can't try to get around technical protection measures that involve access of the software. And one of the arguments was is that EFI does exactly this. It prevents you from accessing portions of the code which are copyright protected. So they've tweaked that argument a little bit, and now they're also bringing in these EULA issues, including a first sale issue, which is another thing that we talked about last week. It would be the ability of the owner of, or I want to say the owner, the ability of a licensed software possessor to resell the product after they've initially bought it, which is something you can't do under a license, but it's been an issue of contention, like in the Werner v. Autodesk case that we discussed last week. And they're also finally arguing for preemption of the EULA in Florida, which is something I think weeks and weeks ago, probably back to our first couple of podcasts that I discussed in length about copyright preemption issues, and that is you're sort of frustrating the purposes of the Copyright Act. Since it's so early, though, we really don't have a good handle on where these things are going to go, but I think it's really interesting to talk about these and see that there is a person that is willing, or a company that is willing, to sort of step up to the plate against one of these big tech giants and challenge the validity of at least just this EULA. And interestingly also, Sisar's not saying that all EULAs should be invalid. It's just the one at issue in this case. So any other thoughts on where this might go before we sum things up for the day?
That's all I have, but we'll definitely be keeping a close eye on it.
Great. Well, thank you for tuning in this week. As always, you can send us comments about the podcast to podcast@technicallylegal.org. Be sure to visit our site at technicallylegal.org, too. We have lots of interesting posts up. And signing off for this week, I was your host, David O'Brien, and with me,
Dominic Rabia
and Ben Snitkoff.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next week.